Buddhist Summer School, Sunday, 16th August, 1987. Sunday School is an established institution in Christendom. It is in diminishing measure nowadays as compared with past centuries. Affluence and the welfare state have wrought many changes in the lives of many people, some of which are not for the better. Mankind has yet to learn that a decent austerity offers a middle way for a good and happy secular life, denied by the extremes of poverty or affluence. In the days of the Buddha, there flourished a mode of behavior by a son in that he obeyed scrupulously and conscientiously the requests of his dying father. The youth Sigala was brought up, perhaps a little indulgently, by his parents who were pious upasakas, lay followers of the Buddha. Sigala had no bias in favor of hearing the good teaching. He says, "I will have nothing to do with religious teachers. Doing homage to them would make my back ache, my knees stiff. I should have to sit on the ground and spoil my clothes. And after hearing their teaching, I would have to invite them to lunch and give them presents. So one only loses by it." That was the young Sigala's opinion. The father thought out a plan as he lay dying. If the boy were enjoined to perform the worship of the six quarters, which was an established Hindu ceremonial, that is, the six quarters being the four cardinal points, the nadir and the zenith, the Buddha or one of his arahants was sure to see him as he went on his arms round to Rajagaha, which is the modern town of Rajgir. Being a dutiful son, Sigala regularly carried out his father's dying wish. A commentary on this discourse, which is known as the Sigalovada Sutta, has it that the teacher, surveying the world at dawn with his Buddha vision, had already seen the youth's devoted worship and decided, "Today I will discourse to Sigala the layman's duty. That discourse will benefit many. There must I go." And sure enough, the exalted one, entering Rajagaha, seeking alms, saw Sigala and said, "Why do you, young householder, rising early and leaving Rajagaha with wet hair and raiment, worship the several quarters of earth and sky?" Sigala explains that it was his dying father's wish that he should do so. The Buddha says, in the religion of an Aryan, the quarters should not be worshipped thus. Remember, the Hindus of the Buddha's day considered themselves Aryans. The first meaning is the worthy ones. Sigala prays the Buddha to tell him how, in the religion of an Aryan, the six quarters should be worshipped. The Buddha then gives the long homily, which is quite pertinently regarded as the householder's vinaya, in which all the duties of the houseman are mentioned. The Buddha starts by mentioning 14 evil things which the Aryan disciple puts away. They are 4 vices in conduct, evil actions from 4 motives, and 6 channels for squandering wealth. The 4 vices in conduct are injuring or destroying any living thing, including plants. The taking of what is not given. That is how it is put literally in the Silas as such. I feel that if we could add a little bit to it, it might have a stronger feel. The taking of what is not freely given with love. That's quite different from just not taking, the taking of what is not given. Because one may give out of custom, out of just the general practice, and so on. The third is sensual indulgence and lying speech. Abstention from these has to be not only in deeds, but also in thought and speech and feeling. This point is specially emphasized in the Shandilya Upanishad and in Zarathustrian teachings. Although deeds are regarded as more important than thoughts, here of course the Buddha introduced a completely contradictory idea that the thought is much more important than the deed. In the Upali Sutta you will find how he works that out and converts Upali from being a Jain to being his follower. So in Zarathustrian teachings, the succinct teaching of good thoughts, good words, and good deeds embraces the whole field of moral living. I think that in the third sila, the words kamesu michachara, which are overstressed as licentiousness in the form of sexual immorality, probably include all forms of sense indulgence. If I crave for music, be it of the good or the excruciating variety, I am likely to be a nuisance to my neighbors. Radios blaring in the house, or one practicing his concertos 6 hours a day, which I used to do in my time, or overpowering a full orchestra as a prima donna or a heroic tenor. If I am addicted to reading books or painting pictures, I can easily forget the saucepan on the cooker till smoke and smell put a stop to my indulgence and saddle me with a burnt saucepan. No wonder the Buddha emphasized constant mindfulness, samasati, even as Krishnamurti did in our century. As far as I'm aware, there is an additional point in Krishnamurti's presentation. He taught, be intensely aware of any thought or feeling or desire when it arises and work it out fully so that there is a complete end to that thought or feeling or desire. This is really a very important point. You practice it and see what happens. If we can do this, there is no karmic leftover to burden the psyche. The substrate for rebirth, as it has been called in Buddhist writings. With the psyche emptied of any possible uprising of any of the aggregates, rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara, vijnana, you realize that unshakable freedom of mind of which the Buddha spoke in the Mahasaropama and especially in the Chula Saropama Sutta. It's rather interesting that the shorter sutta is really the more important one. The four motives from which evil deeds are done are partiality, enmity, stupidity, and fear. As these four are closely bound up with each other, freedom from any one of them involves freedom from the others also. Let us consider partiality for a while. Purely for convenience, let us talk in theistic terms. The majority of people in the world hold the idea of a creator God. They say that God created the universe. We, members of the human species, say that such and such things are good and that certain other things are evil, painful, horrible, and intolerable by us. When they inquire how could a God postulated by us, remember, as wholly wise, loving, all-powerful, good and perfect, allow evil in the world? Why does he not destroy evil? How could he let us suffer as we do? Today, we do know that there is no such thing as destruction in the sense of annihilation. There is only constant change. Neither you nor I, neither God nor his one-time brightest angel Lucifer, now dubbed the devil, can throw or even push out evil from the universe, leave alone annihilate it. For where, oh where, is the cosmic dustbin in which to throw out the rejects of the cosmos, which are considered evil? You may feel like fighting and vanquishing the devil. Go ahead and try it out. I will pay a fortune for a front seat view of this fight. And when you stop fighting and come home covered with dust and sweat, glorious and gory, I will have a scented warm bath ready for you, cover you in clean raiment like white samite, mystic and wonderful, and greet you, my beloved brother, with a hail, Don Quixote, you magnificent old fool, who art just like me. I know from my own experience in life. So, God does nothing. He just sits. He does not think, but just looks on, well knowing that the laws which he infused into his universe, namely change and evolution and transmutating healing, which is karma, will ineluctably work out rightly. But can you and I just sit and look on as we are? No, for we live in time, whereas God lives in eternity. Eternity, which is not endless time, but the immediate now. When you and I see, understand, and voluntarily and totally cooperate with the law, we also, as whole beings, holy beings, with the eye made single, will live in eternity, the immediate now. Then partiality, stupidity, enmity and fear will be no more, for they will have been transformed into wholeness, wisdom, compassion and fearlessness. When may this happen? Now. For all our yesterdays and all our tomorrows are held in the absolute creative now. If and when eternity absorbs your consciousness, eternity absorbs you, not you touch eternity. For you as you are not infinite, you will know that this is true, quite true. How may it happen? I say happen because it cannot be brought about, it cannot be engineered. When we let go of everything absolutely, recall the Buddha's affirmation to Ananda, freedom from all grasping is deathlessness. Then you have ceased to prevent it from happening. Like the lilies of the field, you neither toil nor spin anymore. You will have flowered into the absolutely beautiful. Pretty words, you say. But could you put it in practical terms? I have already put it in practical terms. I will now put it in the context of grasping after a result for oneself or for society, which is only oneself by self-identification. The world, however, calls it practicality. It is just this. Be clearly conscious of anything and everything, whatever it may be, without reacting for it or against it. Thus, one is free from partiality. Your response to it will then be the right response, if and when a response is necessary. All too often, no response is necessary to the impression that comes to you. You just stay quiet. But when there is a response necessary, then the response will be right. If you do not react for or against it, whatever it may be, whether it's called good or whether it's called bad. Because in that absolutely impartial, dispassionate observation, you release an energy for healing the situation. The Buddha discloses the six channels for dissipating wealth. He wasn't an unpractical man. Being addicted to intoxicating liquors, that's one. Frequenting the streets at unseemly hours, haunting fairs there were no cinemas, music halls, nightclubs in those days. Being infatuated by gambling, associating with evil companions. You find this instruction in every religion, to keep away from evil companions. The habit of idleness, that's the sixth one. Under each of these six headings, he points out six other evils, all of which spell ruin and misery. Drink is an expensive vice leading to quarrels and violence, disease and impaired intelligence. We may add, in our times, since Sir Walter Raleigh, tobacco. It was Sir Walter Raleigh who brought tobacco into England, wasn't it? That's it. It tends to make one insensitive aesthetically and weakens character. Street walking at the wrong time spells defenselessness for oneself and family and for one's property. One is suspected as the doer of crimes committed by others. Drunken drivers of bullock carts may ditch the produce of hard work. Good roads appear in India only during and after the days of Ashoka in the 3rd century BC. Gambling seems to have been co-evil with the earliest beginnings of social life in man's history. A winner begets hatred, and the loser is miserable. Gambling was a major responsible factor leading to the great war, the Mahabharata, between the Kurus and the Pandavas in India. A gambler's word carries no weight in a court of law. It does nowadays, if he has to give evidence. Despised by friends and those in authority, he is not sought after in marriage, for it is felt that he is unlikely to be able to support a wife and family. In the hymns of the Rig Veda, it is thought that the displeasure of the gods is sometimes due to wrongdoing through gambling. The gambler, libertine, tippler, cheat, swindler, and man of violence are all classed by the Buddha as evil companions. They are to be shunned, just as one would keep well away from the devil. As for idleness, besides necessary work remaining undone, new wealth is not produced, and what one already has dwindles away. Laziness is one of the obstructions for him who would be a yogi. And we have the wise saying, "The devil hath work for idle hands." The Buddha has much to say about friends, true and false. He warns Sigala against the man who pretends to be a friend but is actually a foe. Such a man is rapacious, makes much of you, but is ungenerous to you. He is self-concerned, pursuing his own interests. He deceives you with empty professions of friendship, but excuses himself when you are in need. He flatters you to your face, but speaks ill of you to others. He can be your boon companion in folly and for evil doing, but slinks away from good doing. let the wise man keep a distance from him. The Buddha then speaks of the true friend. He who is a helper, a friend in your hour of need, is indeed your friend. And we have the English saying, a friend in need is a friend indeed. He guards you, he protects you and your family and property when you are in trouble. The true friend is the same to you in prosperity and adversity. He saves you from wrongdoing, advises you wisely, is trustworthy, keeps your secrets, and shows you the way to heaven. He does not forsake you in your troubles. He even lays down his life for your sake. St. John chapter 15 verse 13, if no man hath greater love than this, that he lays down his life for your sake. He rejoices over your prosperity. He restrains anyone who speaks ill of you. Gotama speaks of the virtuous and intelligent layman in the world amassing wealth like a bee gathering honey without hurting anyone. For the wealthy man can benefit his clan. Here again, the Buddha supports one of the beneficial activities of the prevalent caste system. It was the duty of the Vaishya caste, the merchant caste, to amass wealth and for the king to have vast stores of grain. And when there were times of famine, that grain was delivered freely to everybody. And the same in a smaller way by the individuals who were wealthy. He advises the industrious one to divide his wealth into four parts, two of which went into conducting and promoting his business. What a lot the Buddha knew about the business world of his day. One part to save and reserve for use in times of need, and one part to spend and taste the fruit thereof for himself and his family, including gifts to recluses and Brahmins and to those who were destitute. It seems as if there was no inland revenue department in those days until after the founding of the Mauryan Empire by Chandragupta Maurya, about 322 BC. Chandragupta Maurya had crossed swords with Alexander when he invaded India, and he was an exceptionally skillful general. And he, by sheer conquest, of course blood and thunder again, carved out his own empire consisting of the whole of northern India. Roughly you may draw a line from Bombay to Calcutta, modern Calcutta, you see, about that much. And then his son Bindusara extended it further south, almost to the very ends of India, you see. So that the Mauryan Empire as such was approximately 2 million square miles in area, including the whole of what we call Afghanistan today and parts of what is now the southern Soviet Union. Expensive wars of conquest and the running of an empire of the size of a subcontinent meant taxation to the tune of something like 60% at certain periods. This is after the founding of the Mauryan Empire. That's 200, 300 years after the Buddha. Immediately after giving his advice to the businessman, the Buddha presents his original interpretation of the six quarters, saying, "And now, O young householder, and how, O young householder, does the Aryan disciple protect the six quarters?" The following should be looked upon as the six quarters. Parents to the east, as the east. Teachers as the south. Wife and children as the west. Friends and companions as the north. Servants and workpeople as the nadir. Religious teachers and Brahmins as the zenith. You must note very carefully the number of times the Buddha always includes the Brahmins. And if you read your Itivuttaka carefully, you will see he himself declares, "Because I am a Brahmin." And the last canto of the Dhammapada, the canto of the Brahmin, expounds the Brahmin as one who is the first class Buddhist. The Buddha tells Sigala that even as the parents supported the children, so too the children should support the parents in their old age. Keep up the lineage and tradition of the family and be worthy of their heritage. The parents express their love for the children by restraining them from vice, exhorting them to live virtuously, training them for a profession, arranging a suitable marriage, and in due time handing over their inheritance to them. Regarding the pupil-teacher relationship, pupils should stand up when their teachers come in. We do that to this day, don't we? Or is it going out of fashion? I know that the children used to stand up during my teaching days. In schools, they would always stand up. Wait upon them, render personal service, and be attentive in class. The teachers, in their turn, train him in the lore of every art, speak well of him among friends and companions, and provide for his personal safety. See that they were not bullied by the big fellow in the class. Regarding husbands and wives, the wife should be ministered to by her husband by respect, courtesy, and faithfulness, by investing her with complete authority in the household. She was absolute mistress in the home, just as he was absolute master outdoors in the field or in his professional work. He had to provide her with adornment. Her duties to him were performed by fidelity to him, by due hospitality to the kith and kin of both herself and her husband, by proper care of the goods he brought, and by skill and industry in discharging all her business. Sounds like a Victorian morality, doesn't it? All the above deals with the protection and worship of the eastern, western, and southern quarters, which are concerned with the family circle. The Buddha proceeds by saying that a clansman should minister to his friends and familiars by generosity, courtesy, and benevolence, by treating them as well as he treats himself. Do unto others as you would them do unto you. And by being as good as his word. It is specially interesting to note that the instruction to keep one's word comes right from Rig Vedic times. Mitra was the god who saw to it that each person kept his word, and the contemporary Zarathustrian code also emphasized this. If I remember rightly, Xenophon, in his Cyropedia, The Education of Cyrus, mentions this, and a century or so ago, Colonel Sleeman, afterwards Major General Sleeman, who served in India, notes with high approbation in his memoirs the trustworthiness of Indian people. He wrote in his Journey Through Oud, Volume 2, pages 68 and 9, "I have had before me," he must have been a judge of some sort or other, besides being an army man, "I have had before me hundreds of cases in which a man's property, liberty, and life depended upon his telling a lie, and he has refused to tell it." Oud was one of the eastern provinces, Oud, Orissa, all that part, you see. Marco Polo says that the Brahmin merchants were famous for their honesty and would not tell a lie for anything on earth. We all know the old saying regarding England, "An Englishman's word is his bond." The Buddha goes on to say that friends and familiars protect him when he is off his guard, and also his property and family. They do not forsake him in his troubles, but become his refuge in danger. The Aryan master ministers to his household servants and his employees by requiring them to work only according to their strength for their food and wages and living quarters. When they are ill, he sees to it that they receive medicines and medical attention. When the family enjoys a festive occasion, they are offered a share with the delicacies. They also enjoy regular holidays and special extra food and clothes and adornment for festivals. In their turn, the servants and employees are up before dawn and at work. They take their rest for a while at midday and lie down for their night's sleep after the master and mistress have gone to bed. They speak their employer's praise and fame. To recluses and Brahmins, deep respect and affection is shown in thought and word and deed. Open house is kept for them to supply all temporal needs. In their turn, recluses and Brahmins give unstintingly of their psychological and spiritual wisdom. It is only right to note that in this discourse, the Buddha confirmed the customary Brahmanical social morality of Vedic civilization. This was the established order, actually. What is original with the Buddha is this, in this Sigalovada Suttanta, is the supreme good sense and psychological perceptivity of the Buddha in turning a more or less impotent ritualistic ceremony into a valuable practice of social living. You will find this sutta in the Digha Nikaya, in the third volume. Well, what do you think of the Buddha's practical social morality and mode of living?